Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Today we have two guests who will be talking about something that is actually the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Over 5 million people in America, 35 million people worldwide are living with Alzheimer's. And that really is the focus of today's program and both of our guests, Mr. Greg O'Brien and Dr. Molly Perdue. Both will talk to us about living with Alzheimer's. Greg is a former editor and publisher of the Cape Codder and Register newspapers. Greg is a former editor of Cape Cod Life. He was a founding managing director of a community newspaper in Boston. He is the editor and author of several books, has published 17 books by other writers through his publishing affiliate, Codfish Press. Greg O'Brien, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Now, Greg, you have clearly spent your lifetime as a writer, reporter. You've written and produced documentaries, and you've also been a screenwriter. Today, though, we don't talk about any of those things necessarily. We talk about a diagnosis that you received several years back. What was that diagnosis?
Well, it was about 6 years ago. I received a diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's after horrific memory loss, not recognizing people in familiar places, poor judgment, loss of continence, and rage. By putting in perspective, my maternal grandfather and mother died of Alzheimer's. My paternal uncle died of Alzheimer's about a year ago. And before my father died, he was diagnosed with dementia. I had all the brain scans and tests that confirmed the diagnosis. And I also carry the Alzheimer's marker gene, APOE4.
So what you are dealing with today as we speak is something that you've been dealing with for a while now, and that is a diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's, which really is a diagnosis that strikes fear into the hearts of so many people. And clearly today you're going to be talking about what your life is like living with not only this diagnosis, but you've had some other medical challenges as well. Let me just break away from you, Greg, for a moment. I would like to introduce Dr. Molly Perdue. Molly Perdue is the author of Exploring the Experiences of Family Caregivers, Cape Cod's Invisible Workforce, Upholding the Promise of Olmsted for People with Alzheimer's and Dementia-Related Disease. Dr. Molly Perdue is a founder and executive director of the newly formed nonprofit entity, the Alzheimer's Family Caregiver Support Center. Dr. Molly Perdue, I could go on and on about all the things that you have done and are doing, but I think I'll break away from that and welcome you to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate it. What we're doing here on Cape Cod is that we're trying to get the family involved, because we believe that Alzheimer's disease and dementia-related disease is actually an issue that everyone in the family has to find a way to resolve and work within the context of those diseases. So we're working very hard to try to create programming for everyone. And what makes Greg's story so very, very important is that very rarely do you get to take an inside look at what an actual human being is going through as they experience the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
Absolutely. And Greg, you have chronicled your experiences in a book, which I actually was reading last evening. And Greg, I have to tell you, there are times when it actually brought me to tears. What's the title of your book, Greg?
It's called On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. And it's the first book written by an investigative reporter embedded inside the mind of Alzheimer's, chronicling the progression of his own disease. But this is a disease, if I could just point out, that it's not your grandfather's disease. And yes, my grandfather died of it. It isn't a disease, and Molly can pick this up, it isn't a disease, and this is an important point for your listeners, it isn't a disease that hits when you're in your 80s. It's a disease that can take 20, 25 years to run its course, like having a sliver of your brain shaved every day. And the pathology of it can start when you're in your 40s, the buildup of plaques and tangles before any symptoms. It's a Stephen King thriller of a diagnosis, and there are many people, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, like me, walking around, able to communicate. It's not like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but a lot of them are afraid to come forward and talk and get a diagnosis because they're afraid of the stigma, and they're afraid of losing their jobs. And as a society, we need to stand with them, and as the Congress needs to start to, which they've done a good job of, needs to continue to appropriate funding for a cure.
And I think a lot Molly, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to just add on to that. I mean, what Greg is talking about, which I think is a very pertinent fact that people need to start thinking about and trying to talk about, is that there is so much fear and stigma around these diseases that many times people are kind of suffering in isolation. So because they're so fearful that if they say something about what's going on, that, you know, their employer would not understand, or even their family would not understand. And what I hear, because we run a lot of support groups for people like Greg that are dealing with these symptoms, is that they can even say something to their family, and, you know, their wife or their husband or their daughter or their son says, oh, this is just a part of normal aging. And the one thing we know is that this accelerated decline is not a part of normal aging. And until we can find ways to talk about these diseases accurately and honestly, can we help people that are isolated and are going through this, as Greg talked about, 20, 30 years of symptomology alone? That's something we know we can do something about right now, and it's why what Greg is doing is so important. You know, I've watched him step up in front of people and talk about what he's going through, and every person that is suffering in isolation, when they hear him speak, they feel empowered to connect to help and to try to see what they can do about their own lives. And that type of empowerment is critical. You know, it's just critical to the reduction of suffering around Alzheimer's disease.
You know, just a final, and then I'll shut up here. there's a difference between what we call the senior moment. There's a difference between losing your keys and not knowing you have car keys. There's a difference between not remembering where you parked your car and not knowing you have a car. 2 years ago at the town dump transfer station, it's a polite word for it, I dropped our trash off and then sat back and said, wow, how do I get home? I could call my wife, my kids, friends. My four-door yellow Jeep was sitting right in front of me, and my brain in the moment would not tell me the synapse, and maybe Molly at some point, when you're ready, we'll talk about synapse. My mind would not tell me that was my Jeep, yellow Jeep, sitting right in front of me, big old yellow Jeep.
And
that's the difference.
I think that in those moments, and I know Greg probably and Dr. Perdue can respond to this, in those moments of clearly not knowing, but I'm wondering if you don't know, but you kind of think you ought to know. I mean, what's that moment like when you're standing there without a clue that your car is there and how to get home?
Well, first of all, it's panic and fear. And, I try in my book, and when I talk to draw analogies that people can relate to, it's like a scary dream, and you wake up and you say, was that real or was that a dream? Was that real? Was that a dream? Where am I? What, you know, in time, it'll come back to you in the early stages generally, but not before that period, again, akin to waking up from a scary dream, a nightmare, and saying, was that real or was that a dream?
And what's interesting about what Greg is saying is that it's that variability of the symptoms that makes it so difficult for the medical establishment to discern what's happening in their very, very early stages, but also for the person that is going through this. So one of the ways that Greg talks about this is like you're plugged into a socket, you know, you're plugged into an outlet, and you know, your plug falls out, and all of a sudden it's blank, and that's when he's talking about the panic sets in. And so some of the things that we're learning from science is that, and they're studying this at MIT, that they're actually finding a way to, you know, with using the lab rats, finding a way to stimulate memories in labs that have been designed to have Alzheimer's disease. So what they're starting to recognize is that it's not necessarily that all of the cognition is lost, it's just there's a loss of connectivity. So people cannot connect to the things that they're trying to draw from cognitively. So it is like a disconnect in your brain if you think about it, and you know, it starts where people can then eventually connect back to what they're trying to come up with, and as a person progresses, that becomes more and more difficult.
Greg, I
know. Molly, talk about. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I noticed, Greg, that in your office you have photographs and prints of various things that you've written, articles that you've written, family and friends. How important is that for you to be surrounded by those visual reminders?
Well, it becomes my memory, and at times when I feel out of sorts, I go into my office and sit, and I'm surrounded by all the things that I did in my life, and all the wonderful people, you know, family and friends that I love that are part of my life, and it helps connect the dots. And the dots are very difficult often in time to connect, and Molly can speak to synapse and new pathways. But yeah, it's a place of peace, if that makes sense to you.
It absolutely does. Molly, how does one determine with accuracy that Alzheimer's really is the issue? Are there tests that one should look at? Are there particular signs and symptoms that upon experiencing them, one should really consider getting a medical opinion about what's going on?
You know, what seems to be true is that there's so much fear and stigma. People are afraid of having that conversation with their doctor. And the problem with that is that there can be many reasons for memory loss. Some of them can be organic, and some of them can be treatable. People can be hypothyroid. They can have B12 deficiencies. You can have a clinical depression that interferes with your memory. You could have, you know, there are other abnormalities like brain tumors and serious infections that will interfere with your cognition. So if you're too frightened to have that initial discussion with your doctor, many of these things can go untreated. And for example, you know, Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, but vascular dementia is running in second place. And what we know, and one of the things that I had come across when I was doing my own personal research and finishing my PhD, is that there was a doctor, and one of the things that this medical doctor talked about is that if we did a better job of dealing with our vascular issues, so if we helped people by figuring out if they had vascular disease, we actually could eliminate many of the cases of vascular dementia. And yet, you know, because we're so fearful, we don't go and talk to our doctor. And back to your question, like, how do you know, is that you really need to connect to the medical community. You need to have a cognitive exam. You need to have a discussion and get a referral from your doctor to have an image of your brain, as well as to rule out any organic causes of your possible memory loss. Most people, report that it begins with memory loss. Sometimes it's personality changes. It could be irritability. Sometimes you have difficulty with language. So any of the cognitive areas that can be affected in the brain will be, if you're dealing with an accelerated loss, due to an Alzheimer's or one of the 70 different types of dementias that are out there. So connecting to your medical community, getting information is really critical to combating this disease.
Yeah.
And doctors say that you can have more than one dementia. You can have Alzheimer's and another form of dementia. Another thing, just to say briefly, I've had two serious head injuries, and everyone has heard about pro football and soccer and all that. I had two head injuries that I shouldn't have walked away from. And a head injury will not create Alzheimer's or dementia, but if you're predisposed or the tumblers are in place, as it was for me, a head injury, a serious head injury, could bring it on sooner. And the doctors and their diagnosis have all said that they believe that the head injuries that I had unmasked a disease in the making. And so it's all those variables to think about.
Greg, what were those head injuries about? One of them, as I recall, was you on a bike. But tell us more about those two head injuries.
Well, years ago, went up to visit, I was my mother's caregiver, family caregiver on Cape Cod, and she was moving to the final stages of Alzheimer's. I went up on a bike ride when I was a younger man with my son, Connor, and his friend. And when we got there, we talked to my mom, and, she's, dealing with final stages, and my son, Connor, knew it. One of the things, and Molly could pick this up, is symptoms, is that your internal thermostat in Alzheimer's goes. You dress appropriately, and I'm finding myself, all my friends kid me, but in the summertime, I'm dressing often like it's winter. And in many ways, following the same path as my mother. And so she brought, when the kids were ready to leave, she brought these big, huge sweatshirts out, at a time when they made sweatshirts. Now they just make t-shirts and put hoods on them.
Right.
And so the kids, I made them put the sweatshirts on. As soon as we turned the corner on the bike trail, I said, give them to me, and put them over my handlebars. And I was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. In my mind, it was a beautiful day on Cape Cod, and my mind took me back to when I was a kid. Stupidly, I had no helmet. The kids had helmets. And I remember that I used to drive no-handed without hands, and I started doing that. And I was flying. And something inside my head, I call it God, people may call it something else, said to me, Greg, something bad is about to happen. And in slow motion, I watched one of these sweatshirts slip off, grab the spokes, bring the bike to a full halt. I was thrown 8 feet into the air, landed on the paved bike trail. I had my left hand in front of my head, and the cut went through the knuckles, and then my hand fell away. My head hit the ground, the pavement, twice, and that saved my life. But ambulance ride to the hospital, and doctors felt, that was serious head injury that I should not have walked away from. Just briefly, a year and a half ago, I had a car accident, and I was driving home near my house, and I'm seeing things often that aren't there, and I thought I saw a deer. I'm not sure if it was or not, so I turned my yellow Jeep sharply to the right. It hit a stone wall, went airborne into the parking lot, rolled twice, ripped the top of the roof off. My head hit the windshield with such a force that the wound had to be closed with surgical staples after a ride, ambulance ride to the hospital. And I was told I shouldn't walk away from that either. And ironically, that was in the parking lot of the church where we had my mother's funeral after she died of Alzheimer's. So do you believe in angels?
Greg, it is really stunning the things that you have gone through. And clearly it wasn't your time. Clearly you had work to do, and the work that you had to do, I would suggest in part, is what you're doing today and what you've been doing for a while, which is really sharing your story and helping people to understand what it is like to actually, as you have said, live with Alzheimer's.
Well, I thank you for that. I always tell people, and again, I'm not here to proselytize. We all have different views, whether we see God, the universe, or higher power, whatever. I'm a traditional Irish Catholic, so you can figure that out. But I'm not doing this alone. And so the other day, you know, I got prostate cancer. I got clinical depression. I have spinal stenosis and scoliosis and degeneration of my spine. I have Alzheimer's, and I had a severe bronchitis, which was on the verge of walking pneumonia for 4 months. And so one morning I was angry, and I reached up to God, and I said, do you know who I am? Do you got a clue? And I want a God who's like a Bill Belichick coach, tough coach. And I heard back from God, yes, dumbass, I made you, and I have you right where I want you. And I said, okay, well, then we can move on. And we all need a purpose in life. So,
well, there you go. On that note, Greg O'Brien, Dr. Molly Perdue, we're going to take a break, but we will be right back with more of this conversation. Greg O'Brien, Dr. Molly Perdue, the experiences that Greg has had and is having with respect to the Alzheimer's experience, they include not only memory loss, which is significant and difficult and painful enough, but Greg, in your book, certainly on Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's, you talk about the difficulty with problem solving, the confusion with time, place, and words. You talk about seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling things that aren't there. You talk about not having had feelings in parts of your feet and your hands and your lower extremities for almost 2 years. To both of you, are these typical experiences for folks who experience Alzheimer's? Is there any such thing as a typical experience for folks who are dealing with Alzheimer's?
I'll answer that first and then turn over to Molly. I always tell people, okay, all I did in high school was cut up a frog. But it's been told to me that Alzheimer's is like a snowflake. There are no two patterns that are alike. And where there are common symptoms, I don't know that there's a, and that's what makes it so difficult to cure, that there's a common profile in terms of symptoms. There were some people go into tremendous rage as I do. Other people, it's different. And I think some of it, and I'm kind of curious what Molly has to say, may have something to do with the type of person we are, what our DNA, our psychological makeup, because when the brain starts to shut down, I think it has an impact on those character traits that we have. And Molly, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're completely correct, Greg, and it's true. Everybody goes through this disease differently, and what I think is very important is that every person needs support. When you have a misperception, which we call hallucination, and I think Greg can talk specifically to this one symptom of his disease, it's very frightening, and you know, it's important to be able to talk to someone about your experience. And, you know, we run a lot of support groups for people that are in early stages of these diseases. And in one support group, we had a person that came that had had their first misperception and wanted to talk about it because they were nervous that they did not know how they were going to be in future social situations in case they had another hallucination. So they were a little taken back. They didn't know how they were going to kind of go on with their life after they experienced this symptom of their disease. And so what we were able to do in that support group was talk about it, talk about strategies to deal with it. And this is why the support is so important, is because every person is an individual snowflake. So what happens to one person, it may not happen like that for the next person. And so providing this type of support allows everyone to deal with their own symptoms and find a way to develop strategies. And Greg is, you know, he could teach strategies because he developed so many of these for himself as he moves through this disease that it's really uncanny, and he has a lot to share. And Greg, I don't know if you could talk to that one symptom of misperception or hallucination, but I think some of your stories are just, you know, really heartwarming. So,
well, I deal, and sometimes the misperceptions or hallucinations, whatever you want to call it, are scary, and sometimes they're subtunes of spiders crawling across the ceiling, and this all times of day, and then floating down right in front of me. But my mother had misperceptions, hallucinations, where the floor would open and people would try to drag her through it. And she told me they weren't real, but they were scary in the moment. So I just brushed them away. Recently, I was out in California with my wife to give a speech, and it was a nice, we had to dress up nice, and she said, put your dress shoes on, and I said, I can't. She said, why not? I said, because there's a man standing in them. And in the moment, my mind told me there was someone standing in my shoes. I have a good friend of mine I hang out with. It's kind of like, I call it like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with all my buddies, because you got to laugh at it. So we hang out together, and he's a golfer, and he told me that, and they have some big, those big fluffy covers on his golf clubs, and he yelled at his wife the other day, and he was looking over his golf clubs, and he said, there's a bunch of midgets staring at me, and it's okay to laugh. And Molly has a story about her mother. Molly, you want to tell that story?
Yes. Well, one of the ways that I got into doing this work is my mother had Alzheimer's, and she lived with us while I was raising my two kids. We had my mother, and we lived on in a house that overlooked the Cape Cod Bay. She would look out into the bay, and she would see a buoy out there, and she would think that it was a woman that was drowning. And so she would tell me, we have to call the police. You know, we have to get some help. And what I learned through that, I mean, I was also working on my PhD in this area, so it was very interesting to have all those, the conflation of all those things happening at once. But what I learned was that, and this comes back to your original question, was that how we created the context for which my mother had that hallucination made a difference. So instead of saying to her, you're not seeing that, that's not a woman, you know, you trying to talk her out of it, if I found a way to make the day enjoyable and to say, wow, she's doing really well. Oh, she just swam to safety. I think we're okay. She was able to do better in that misperception when she was at that point of the disease. Now, the other interesting thing about my mother is that she could have that hallucination, and in 5 seconds, she could say, hey, it's 4:00. We got to turn on Oprah. You know, because it was not something where, you know, you kind of move in and you move out of these symptoms. And so helping families learn to understand how to deal with many of these symptoms helps everybody. It helps the person that is experiencing them. It also helps that family member know what to do to make the situation okay.
And that's like in Alzheimer's, it's like a light going on and off. And, sometimes the light goes off. It's like as it goes back on, it goes off. But Molly's story about her mother is at 4:00, and that's when the light went back on. She was watching Oprah. Oprah meant everything to her. And that's how the disease works. Molly, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's great. That's great. It's true. It's really true. And it's why we have to keep putting shows like this. I mean, Dr. Brewer, thank you for putting shows like this out there, because we have to find ways to educate everyone. You know, as you mentioned in your opening, you know, with 5.2 million people nationally, it's really important that everyone gets information. And one of the things Greg does when he speaks is, you know, he asks if is anyone in the crowd that has Alzheimer's, and he's starting to start this conversation so people that were once fearful are able to step out. And then you ask the question, how many of you have a family member or know someone that has this disease? And almost every hand in the room goes up, and it goes up lecture after lecture.
which in some ways I would imagine is frightening, but at the same time comforting. There are so many people who are experiencing this or who will experience this directly or indirectly. Another thing that really strikes me about both you, Greg, and Dr. Perdue, as you talk about the conversations you have with families and support groups and the speeches that you give, clearly what you are both creating is a place that is safe enough for people to actually talk about the things that are truly going on with them. As you've both said, there's so much stigma that so many times people try to keep this secret, but both of you have created spaces and places that people don't have to hide in the shadows when they are dealing with this experience.
Well, it's a lot like cancer. Years ago, they would call it the Big C, and then no one would talk about AIDS, or no one would talk about autism, and the challenge with dementia or Alzheimer's, but the umbrella word is called dementia. It scares people because the word, break it apart, sounds like a demon howling in the desert. And so that's something a lot of people want to talk about.
And both Greg and I dealt with our parents. So what was interesting about our parents' generation is no one spoke about it. I mean, my mother, I could sometimes say memory loss, and that was about as far as we could go. The A word was not allowed. And what happens in that is that you don't get to have any of these discussions, and there are a lot of public health concerns that cannot get addressed if you can't even talk about what's happening for someone. So, Greg talked about driving. Driving is something where, you don't want to immediately upon diagnosis, especially if someone's in the beginning stages, say you can absolutely not drive anywhere, because that may not be a correct estimation of someone's abilities, and yet you want to connect that person to their doctor to have that discussion, or to some program that can give information about driving safety. But if you can't even broach the subject, how do you deal with the public health issue or the issue around finances? Many times in an early stage, it's very difficult to be able to manage your money or to manage your checkbook or your credit cards. And so do we want people that are going out and buying three new cars because they had forgotten that they had gone to the dealership the year before? So there are all these issues that if you don't get the conversation started, we're not going to be able to address. And the conversation has to begin with the family, with the medical community, and kind of move outwards. What we know from the research is that when families connect earlier to services, they do better in the long run. Many times the family members can have poor health outcomes because they're trying to deal with all of this individually without other support. So, it's a big drain on what we call, human resources, within our families. So it is important to get the conversation going.
Let me just interrupt for a second, because I'm hearing a lot of background noise. I'm not sure which end it's coming from, but just to remind you that the mic is very sensitive, so we really need to try to keep the background noise really down. I'm now going to ask Greg, I'm going to ask you a question and continue the interview conversation. Greg, you talked about being with your wife as you were traveling to California. We've yet to talk about how you actually have dealt with your wife, your children, your family members when this diagnosis became known to you. How are you all doing as a family?
Well, it's tough. It's brought us closer together, and but they've seen it, and they know it's in the family, and they saw it firsthand with my mother. But it's made us stronger. And there's always the denial in the beginning, and I was in denial. And there's a great quote from Mark Twain: "Denial ain't just a river in Egypt." And but there you come out of it, and then you deal with the reality of life. and it has made us stronger. So, and they're all involved in the Alzheimer's organizations and care now. My son Connor, for example, I can't go anywhere alone, and he works with me now. So he's my right hand guy. He's 27.
Which I would think is an extraordinary experience for Connor as well.
Yeah, I mean he's going all over the country, and there was a documentary PBS Nova that he was on, as well as me and my family, and he's been on interviews around the country. So it's been a good experience for him. And you're absolutely right.
The experience of getting the Alzheimer's diagnosis, Greg, you also have another diagnosis. You talked about it briefly earlier on. There's a cancer diagnosis, and you've declined cancer treatment. Can you speak to that decision?
Yeah, my father also had prostate cancer, and I have it in 5 places in my prostate, and in fact, haven't been to the urologist, I think that's what they call them, in 2 years, so I have no idea where it is. But I've just seen that end stage and don't want to take my family. I mean, we're facing bankruptcy, okay? And I want to limit the black hole that I'm going to take them into. And, you know, everyone talks about a cure, and sure, we're making great progress. But for people like me, a cure is a long way away. And so I don't want to take them to that place.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that what Greg is touching on are the very, very high costs associated with this disease. You know, the Alzheimer's Association had estimated that the cost per family is roughly like $174,000. That's the lifetime cost that families are facing. You know, many families face, you know, these extreme costs out of pocket when a person is still symptomatic in the community. And then as a person progresses through the disease, the costs just rise. And this creates a financial burden for every family, because they're trying to figure out, how are we going to be able to absorb the cost of this disease? And so it's not just that costs are skyrocketing for many programs, you know, for Medicaid and Medicare, but it's also skyrocketing for each individual family that is facing this disease. So in that way, it is, an epidemic. Something like 7,000 to 10,000 people are becoming seniors every day. And as we know, age is the number one risk factor for this disease. And so the older you are, the higher the prevalency rate. So it's something that we really have to deal with from a public policy area. You know, we have to think about ways to provide more support to families. And another interesting statistic is that 70% of people that are symptomatic are in their community. So they're dealing with these symptoms in their homes, in these very private areas, yet we do not have 70% of programming for families out in the community, where people really need them, where they need to learn coping strategies and education and ways to deal with what is happening in their families, or getting good legal advice, or having healthcare proxies so they know who's going to be in charge of setting up the care plan. And we are just at the beginning of talking about these issues.
And I would guess that these are all issues that are frequent parts of the conversation with the support groups that you are involved in, Dr. Perdue.
Absolutely. When we started the Alzheimer's Family Support Center, one of the first things that we did is we decided that we were going to blanket Cape Cod and our geographic area with a support group in each town. And then after we blanketed, you know, all of our region with support groups, we were going to make sure that we had support groups for people that were also symptomatic, so that everybody can get the information that they need. And everything we do is free of charge. We don't sit down and say, what's your insurance? We sit down and say, how can we help you? And I think that's really making the difference in how we're growing our program. Because we feel that there is such a heavy burden that a family is carrying that until a disease is found, we have to find ways to provide the support that people need. And we're busy doing that every day in our region.
You know, Dr. Brewer, just talk about the financial drain. When I was first diagnosed and started going through the symptoms and I realized there was a lot that I couldn't do anymore, I went through all of my retirement, and that's not uncommon. So here I am still having to work, like many with Alzheimer's, and I have a group of people around me, so I make less money now because I have to pay them, and I have no retirement. So when I slip and I can't work anymore, that my family goes into that black hole, and I'm fighting against that. And in my case, I'm just a stubborn Irishman, and I think it helps me in my fight.
It sounds like it does indeed. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back to continue this very important conversation with Greg O'Brien and Dr. Molly Perdue. Greg, as we've been talking today, you've been talking about hanging out with your friends, speeches that you've given, certainly a book that you've read. I mean, you are keeping very, very busy. And I think that for many people, the myth and the fear is that literally within weeks of getting a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, your life is going to be over as you once knew it. But clearly, what you're describing is a life that you are living to the fullest extent in which you are able. Can you speak to that a little bit more for the folks who are listening who may be still kind of frightened?
Well, what likely happens, and I want to hear what Molly says, is because it's kind of the rule, is that because people are so afraid to talk about this, they experience these symptoms and they won't talk about it. So the symptoms progress, and maybe 10 years later or 12 years later, as the symptoms have progressed to the point that they can't function the way they could before, then they start talking about it and they're in the weeds. What I'm trying to do is to get people to get the early diagnosis and with support from, you know, organizations, you know, caregiving organizations and medication. I take the legal limits of medication. You can live with this disease for a while, but it's based on early diagnosis. And understandably, there are a lot of doctors who don't understand Alzheimer's. And they can tend to either write it off or not tell a patient, and Molly can talk about this, but many of them don't even tell their patients that they've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's for the simple reason that they say, well, there's nothing you can do. And that's so sad. We do have rock stars in the medical field in Alzheimer's. And so I would suggest if you're going to, if your symptoms get in the way of, being able to function daily, go get a clinical test, but go to experts who do that for a living, because that's your best bet. It's such a complicated disease. There are many people in the medical field who don't understand it. And sometimes, you know, in moving forward, they walk as if they understand more than they really do. You need to go to an expert. Molly, do you agree with that?
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I just want to mention that we get a lot of phone calls from folks that had just received the diagnosis, and they don't know what to do. They're fearful. They don't know who to turn to. They have a lot of questions about what's going on. And what we do is we say, okay, you know, I'll set up an appointment. I'll go into their home. We'll sit around the dining room table, and we'll talk. And one of the things that I find helpful when I speak to families that have just received this diagnosis is that I ask them, Okay, so what did you do the day before your diagnosis? And they say, well, you know, I went to the store, I went to work, I did this and I did that. I said, okay, so that's a good indication of what you're going to be able to do today, because the downward slope happens very slowly. These diseases develop, you know, 20, 30, 10, you know, 8 years. So the best indication of what your day is going to be like possibly tomorrow is what your day was like today. And the point of that is that life goes on after a diagnosis. You know, people experience their lives. Lives are complex. They're filled with good times. They're filled with challenging moments. And that is true for the person that is also symptomatic. You know, I recall my own mother's progression. And when she needed some support, and she came from Florida to Cape Cod to live with me, she went to weddings. Her grandson took his first steps into her arms. She enjoyed her life. And this is also true. And this is what creates the complexity around the disease progression, is that life does not end, it goes on. And for that purpose, it is critical that we help people symptomatic continue living their lives and having as fulfilling a life as possible in spite of the obstacle and the challenges of these diseases.
And I think clearly what Greg is saying is that living your life as fully as possible is actually possible. Because, Greg, that's clearly what you are doing.
Yeah. Now, yes. But I do want to say, because it's important for me to say that we're all able to fight at different levels. There are no two, repeat myself again, there are no, it's snowflakes here. There are no two examples that are the same. And, you know, I asked the question, why does cancer take out people quicker than others? Why does Alzheimer's, in some cases, take out people quicker than others? In some cases, it may be that the symptoms really started 20 years ago and the individual just didn't feel compelled to talk about it. Or it could be at an accelerated level. There could be other things involved. So I want to be careful and sensitive. I can just talk about my experience. I'm a fighter. But I always tell people when I speak, lying in wrestling is a position of defeat. So to the extent that you can, get off the mat. And the best way to get off the mat is to tell yourself that life is not over. And I urge everyone to walk in faith, hope, and humor. And they can define their own faith, but to walk in faith, hope, and humor.
Greg, I'm curious about what this experience has been like for you today. We've been talking now for under an hour, but just. I've certainly been digging into your life, into your history, into your life today. What's this experience been like for you today as we speak?
Well, glad you asked, because 2 minutes ago, I said, thank God Molly is on the phone, because it's draining. And my mind is like a battery, a small battery that needs to be recharged more and more. And when the battery goes down, I go down. So conversation like this is very draining. The potential to reach people motivates me beyond feeling drained, but I'm thrilled that Molly is on the call today. After this is over, I'll need to recharge. You know, I used to think of my brain as a big garbage pail. Now you dump all sorts of stuff in it, good, bad, and different. In Alzheimer's, the brain's ability to process shrinks, and now I think of my brain as a flower vase, but I choose priorities, and in a interview like this, it's important. I mean, there are train wrecks in my life. My family sees it, but you know, if we just talked about the train wrecks, or if you saw the train wrecks, then you'd feel sorry for me, and I don't want you to feel sorry for me. This isn't my story. This is your story and your listener's story, and I want them to try to get that.
Greg, you speak in your book about working on cognitive reserve, that your doctors have told you that that's part of what you're doing as you continue to speak and write and do so many of the things that you did before. What's your sense of that, Greg? And Molly, what's your thought about that notion of cognitive reserve?
In simplest forms, the way the doctors explained to me is that cognitive reserve is like an extra fuel tank in your boat. And my mother had a cognitive reserve, and it's a blessing from God. But when that reserve tank is gone, it's a reserve tank of intellect or ability, whatever. These are all gifts. So, but when that tank is gone, I'm gone. And they've told me to preserve the tank, reserve it, and I can't function in slow motion. So, I sprint. Molly, what do you think?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about cognitive reserve is that for someone like Greg, he's working really hard every day to help others, kind of find ways to move through this disease. And his efforts are inspirational in this way, because many times we don't know how to think about what a person is going through. And now we're given some insight. And by being given insight, people can find ways in their own way to be courageous. And that is critical. That is critical. Sometimes I hear people in the medical field talk about cognitive reserve as well. You know, he worked really hard to fool us, you know, to hide his disease symptoms. And the realities are people are working hard because they want to have purpose in their lives, they want to connect to the people in their lives, and they want to continue to have fulfilling lives. And to that purpose, you know, it is our responsibility to find ways for people like Greg and their families in a way that they can help them continue moving to that purpose. I think that is a very important message that we need to get out there.
And Doctor, you have referred to Greg as an American hero. I think we know why.
It's true. It's true. He hates it when I say that. You know, we speak, and I always say, you know, you're my hero, and I say that when we're not speaking in front of anyone, and it's true. Greg provides inspiration to me, as my mother did, and as his mother did to him. You know, this is a disease that many of us are touched by our families, and we know that there has to be some innovative ways that we can find a way to make a difference, to help the next generation. Until a cure is found, you know, it is upon us. You know, it's a challenge of our time to find ways to do this for each other, to reduce the suffering, and to reduce the suffering now. And I do feel very strongly about that. And, you know, I would do, you know, I would help Greg, and I would do anything to help him further his cause. And I do believe that anyone should pick up his book. On Pluto is an amazing book. I think it will help people understand what's going on, and I would highly recommend it to any of your listeners.
And I have to echo
doctor,
that.
Dr. Brewer, I'm no hero, okay? I get back to my soul issue. I'm doing what I feel God, the universe, whatever has told me to do. I'm an ordinary guy. I tell people I've committed every sin in life other than adultery and murder, and I've been tested in both. So I'm no hero, and that makes me anxious when people say,
well,
that.
We don't want to make you anxious.
Sorry, Greg.
But you know, Greg, I hear you that this has really been draining on you, and I'm going to let you go in just a second. But as I let you go, I would just like to share with the listeners a quote from you in which you say, "My brain used to be my best friend, but today I see no chance for reconciliation, and so I've learned to write and speak from the heart, the place of the soul. Today I am here to encourage you on your journey." And with that, Greg, I have to say once again, thank you so very much for joining us today. Dr. Perdue, if you would just hang on for a moment, there are some other things that I would like to ask you to talk to us about. But, Greg, thank you again.
Okay. God bless you, Molly. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Okay, Greg. Take care.
All right. See ya.
Alrighty, and again, folks, you were listening to Greg O'Brien, who is the author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. And again, Dr. Perdue, I have to completely agree with you. The book is extraordinary. I actually looked through the book, and there were places in which it brought me to tears. It is an extraordinary journey that is so honest and so powerful. Dr. Perdue, Greg talked about being diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. What does early onset mean? I mean, most people think about an Alzheimer's diagnosis, I would suggest, is, you know, you're 70, you're 80, you're 90. But he was diagnosed much earlier.
Yes, Greg was diagnosed at 59. And if you're diagnosed before the age of 65, they call it early stage, early onset Alzheimer's. And when you look at the figures in the United States, 5.4 million people, a quarter million, 250,000 roughly, are symptomatic before the age of 65. So it's really the onset just happens earlier in your lifespan than it does for most others. There is a familial type of Alzheimer's that is a very low percentage of people have that. And that is, if you look at the Colombian families that are being studied, maybe 9 out of 11 people may end up with familial Alzheimer's in a family if they have that diagnosis. And that's rare. That's around 1% of the population. So you're not talking about, you know, the genetic link in familial being for the later onset, or even for many people that may have early onset but not have that genetic link. So.
When there is a family history of dementia, should you be concerned? Should you assume that this is something that you will experience as well?
So the correlation is not a one-to-one correlation. So the best way risk was ever explained to me by a neuroscientist, and I heard this from Lisa Genova, who wrote the book Still Alice, and she talked about your risk factor increasing. So if your maternal mother has Alzheimer's, you have an increased risk. If you're, you know, if another family member has Alzheimer's, you know, you have an increased risk. If you have poor cardiovascular health, you have an increased risk. If you're diabetic, you have an increased risk. And obviously, the number one risk factor that I mentioned earlier is age. So as you get older, you have an increased risk. So all of these things, if you were to think of it as the hands on a clock, your risk increases until you have a very, very high risk factor if you have all of those things that could contribute to you becoming symptomatic. So, you know, what we know about brain health, and we're just at the beginning of understanding how taking care of our brain will impact our health later on in the life cycle, but we know now what's good for the heart is good for the brain, and we know about exercise, and we know about trying to remain stimulated socially, like not isolating, being out and having positive social interactions. And many of the things that we know are important around healthy aging, we can apply to good cognitive health. And so getting out and not being sedentary as you age and having time with your friends, really, really critical. And this is what we're learning about brain health now.
Dr. Perdue, I want to thank you as well for having joined us today on this edition of Mind Talk. There's a website that I think you can share with the audience if they would like additional information.
Our website is alzheimerscapecod.org. So alzheimerscapecod.org.
Thank you again so very much for joining us today, Dr. Molly Perdue. Director of Family Services at Hope Healthcare of Cape Cod. Thank you, Dr. Perdue.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26 by 2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to Pamela, that's P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember, always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.